Welcome to A Closer Look, a special KSKA presentation. A Closer Look allows us to offer listeners a chance to learn more about a recent news story or to profile in depth the people who impact our community. I'm Annie Feit. This half hour, we're presenting a conversation with Dr. Jane Lubchenco, head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The agency is responsible for conserving and managing ocean resources and for understanding and predicting environmental changes on the planet. NOAA has a huge reach in Alaska on a range of issues from commercial fisheries to the health of seals, sea lions, and whales. The agency is also focused on a growing problem that's getting more attention lately, ocean acidification. Dr. Lubchenco spent a week in Alaska recently to gather information and input on the health of the nation's oceans. She sat down with Alaska Public Radio Network's Lori Townsend. Dr. Lubchenco started out by talking about a recent report that summarizes the impacts of climate change in different regions of the United States.
Alaska, the report says, has warmed at over twice the rate of the rest of the nation. That's no surprise to Alaskans, but there is good scientific evidence that suggests that is the case. The average annual temperatures in Alaska have increased by 3.4 degrees, and the average increase in the wintertime is 6.3 degrees. So it's the wintertime changes that are playing out the most. So what that means is earlier snow melt has been documented, obviously changes in sea ice, widespread glacier retreat, and permafrost thawing. All are areas where there has been documented change that is quite significant. The report also points to the fact that the projections for where we will end up by the end of the century are a pretty broad range, and that we have a lot of choice today about whether those are at the high end or the low end of what is possible. So that's an example of NOAA's and other federal agencies' leadership in providing concrete scientific information to help inform the decisions that individual citizens and that our elected leaders will be making.
You mentioned that you've been to Alaska in the past. How long ago was that, and are there things that are different now than the last time you were here?
I first visited Alaska, actually Anchorage, 10 years ago. And it's remarkable to me how much has changed in that time. We were flying today, for example, from Barrow and Dead Horse to Anchorage. And the amount of retreat of glaciers, the amount of drying of the permafrost, the changes that are visible even to a casual observer are pretty dramatic. I've seen firsthand much of the scientific information about how climate change has affected Alaska, and that too is very sobering. So focusing just on climate change alone, there have been many, many changes underway.
And you're in Anchorage to help launch the first Ocean Policy Task Force public meeting. What's the purpose of the task force, and what are you hoping to accomplish at the meeting?
The purpose of the task force is to help advise the president on policies that would be appropriate to help ensure that we have healthy, resilient oceans, and that we are using them wisely without using them up, essentially. We're seeing intense pressures on our nation's oceans from almost every single direction, with existing uses and the new emerging uses. And we believe that it's time to take a step back and be thoughtful about what combination of activities can coexist in an area while minimizing conflicts and making sure that the oceans are sustainable and healthy.
One of the goals of the Ocean Policy Task Force is restoration of our oceans. That sounds like a tall order. Is this even possible?
Ocean ecosystems have we've seen how many ocean ecosystems are resilient, that if we give them a chance to recover, in fact, that can happen. And one of the challenges is to have smart policies that are in place that allow us to use oceans, enjoy oceans, have good, clean jobs from oceans, but in a way that allows, that both protects and restores them. And I do believe that is possible.
There's wide variations in sea ice loss and ocean warming models that are currently being looked at. Are you confident, or how confident are you, that science has a good grasp of the implications of how warming will impact oceans, particularly the near-term implications in the next decade or two?
Most of what we've seen in the Arctic Ocean has led us to believe that warming is happening even faster than many of the models predicted. We do not fully understand everything about climate change. We do know it's happening. We do know that much of what we are seeing with climate change today is a direct result of human activities, and that there are many surprises likely in store. The melting of the ice in the Arctic Ocean is happening at a faster pace than we had predicted, and that is creating new opportunities in the Arctic Ocean, but those opportunities need to be pursued in ways that are precautionary and that take into account the need to ensure that those systems remain healthy and remain resilient through the coming changes.
Ocean acidification is an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in Alaska recently. How high a priority is this problem for NOAA, and what is the agency doing to address it?
Ocean acidification is emerging as likely very important. Ocean acidification happens. The oceans are becoming more acidic because of the carbon dioxide that people have put into the atmosphere. The oceans have absorbed around a third of the amount of carbon dioxide we have put into the atmosphere. That has brought benefit to slowing down global warming, if you will, but it has also resulted in making the oceans 30% more acidic. As animals and plants in the ocean that make calcareous skeletons, as they are making those skeletons, the rate at which those skeletons or shells are made and the rate at which they are dissolved are a function of the acidity of the ocean. So ocean acidification likely has important consequences for much of life in the oceans, and yet we don't fully understand exactly how that's going to play out. We just know it's likely to be very important.
And in that same vein, do you think enough Americans even understand what ocean acidification is?
Ocean acidification is a relatively new phenomenon, and I'm sure that most Americans are not very up to speed on the fact that it's happening. There is increasing focus on climate change, and appropriately so. We need greater public awareness about the fact that the oceans are becoming more acidic, and that gives us yet another reason for the urgent need to reduce carbon emissions, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks professor just identified acidification as a huge threat to northern fisheries in the next decade. Do you agree with that?
We know that when the oceans become more acidic, it will affect everything from the smallest microscopic plants and animals in the ocean to much, much larger things. And indeed, everything with a shell or a calcareous skeleton is likely to be affected by ocean acidification. This is a new enough problem that we don't completely understand its ramifications. It will likely affect many fisheries.
Do you think that, is there enough monitoring of the problem taking place?
There is not enough monitoring of ocean acidification. This is an area where we desperately need more instruments in the water and more laboratory studies to help us understand the consequences of the increasing acidification of oceans.
NOAA is currently reviewing petitions to list ringed and bearded seal under the Endangered Species Act. A finding was due May 28th. Why isn't that decision out yet?
To make decisions about listing threatened or endangered species requires a considerable amount of information. That information needs to be credible, needs to be evaluated properly, and that takes time. We would like to be able to, I believe we're moving as rapidly as we can in making those determinations, but it has to be done carefully.
And NOAA is supposed to release its critical habitat rule for endangered Cook Inlet beluga by October. Is NOAA on track, do you think, to reach that decision by then?
We are doing everything we can to move as rapidly as possible.
Why does NOAA have trouble meeting these deadlines under the ESA?
The requirements that the information that is required to make an appropriate decision take time and take good information. We are seriously limited in terms of the number of people and the resources we have available to meet all of the requirements for all the different listing decisions. Anytime any federal agency is involved in an activity that might affect a threatened or endangered species, they need to consult with us. So in addition to proposals for new listings, we have immediate responsibilities for activities that might affect already listed species. And we simply do not have the capacity to be dealing with all of those issues in as timely fashion as we would like to be doing.
Is there a conflict with NOAA looking after commercial fisheries and also after mammals like seals and sea lions who also depend on the fish? An example is the decline in pollock stocks in the Bering Sea has been cited as a potential reason for the dramatic decline in the fur seal numbers on Pribilof Islands.
There are inevitable trade-offs in a variety of ocean uses. NOAA is required by law to manage fisheries, to end overfishing, to manage fisheries in a sustainable fashion. We are also required to protect many of the species for which we have responsibility under the Endangered Species Act or the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And we attempt to balance those different legal obligations and to do so in a fashion that is scientifically sound.
You're listening to A Closer Look, a special KSKA program. Today we're presenting an interview with Dr. Jane Lupchenco, head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
King salmon returns have been low on the Yukon River, which has been devastating for people who depend on the fish to fill their freezers. Many blame the pollock fishing fleet and who end up taking salmon as bycatch. Is there anything NOAA can do to address that problem?
It's pretty clear that the Chinook salmon runs are down and that the consequences are indeed being felt in Western Alaskan communities. A lot of attention has focused on reducing the salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery, and the measures recently endorsed by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, I believe, will help in that regard. NOAA Fisheries staff is developing a proposed rule to implement the Council's proposed program. And this proposed rule is scheduled to be published for public review and comment in late 2009. If it's approved, the new Chinook salmon bycatch program would be in place for the 2011 fishery. We do have scientific data from fisheries observers to estimate the amount of salmon bycatch, but unfortunately, we don't have very good information on the other factors that might also be affecting those salmon. I think I can simply say that NOAA will continue to work with the council, with the fishing industry, with local communities to reduce salmon bycatch in Alaska. It's a concern in many fisheries, and NOAA is committed to helping to reduce bycatch, but also to having sustainable fisheries. We're also reviewing the recent request from Governor Parnell to Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, requesting a disaster declaration because of the poor Chinook salmon runs from the Yukon River. So those are under review as we speak.
Generally, in many of Alaska's rivers and in parts of the Pacific Northwest, salmon returns have been abysmally low, and unmet escapement requirements for Canada have caused some fishery closures in Alaska. There's speculation that it may be overfishing, as we mentioned, disease, warming conditions, acidification. There's a variety of things at play here. What kind of priority is NOAA giving to this problem, and what does the current research point to? Is there a smoking gun, or does it encompass a lot of these things?
Unfortunately, there is no smoking gun. It is likely the case that a combination of those factors are contributing, but what the relative contribution from each of them is unknown. It's an issue that we do take very seriously, and we are working closely with the scientists in the region, with the council, with the tribes, to try to understand better the causes and consequences.
NOAA is the agency that represents subsistence whaling to the International Whaling Commission. And with all the current focus on increased shipping in the Arctic and development that will be happening in the future in the Arctic, what, if any, protections are being put in place now or are being proposed to protect bowhead whale migration and subsistence hunting?
One of the things that I was doing in the last couple of days was meeting directly with many of the subsistence whalers in Barrow to understand their interests, their concerns, and to learn from them what they are seeing and what their recommendations are as we move to discharge our responsibilities to them as well as to the endangered bowhead populations. I also was in Dead Horse and Prudhoe Bay meeting with members of the oil industry to understand their perspectives so that we can take all of that into account as we move ahead.
And do you have an idea of when some recommendations may come out?
The Ocean Policy Task Force has a fairly aggressive time schedule. And there are two parts to our charge. The first part, which is due in mid-September, will recommend to the president a national ocean policy, a framework, a governance framework for achieving that, and an implementation plan. The second phase of our charge has to do with marine spatial planning, and our report to the president will be due in mid-December. The listening sessions that we are starting in Anchorage and that will be conducted over the next few weeks in a number of other cities around the country are intended to provide input into both phases of that process. Once we deliver recommendations to the president, I believe that there will be follow-up actions on his part. He has made it very clear that he considers oceans, healthy oceans, to be a strong priority of his. This is an issue that he feels very strongly about. He wants to be informed by both good science as well as input from American citizens. And so it's a special treat to be back here in Anchorage and to be part of the listening sessions so that we can better understand what the concerns and issues are.
U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke announced a ban on expansion of commercial fishing in Arctic waters. The plan also identifies species that would eventually be harvested, Arctic cod and snow crab. What do you think the future is going to look like for fishing in Arctic waters?
Secretary Locke today did approve the plan that NOAA Fisheries had approved that had been recommended unanimously by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, specifically, as you mentioned, the Arctic Fishery Management Plan. It is a landmark plan, and I congratulate the Council for its vision in putting a halt to new commercial fisheries until we have adequate data to tell us that those fisheries can be fished sustainably. I believe that it is the way we should be dealing with many issues in the Arctic. In other words, to proceed smartly, wisely, with caution, to not ban activities outright, but to move ahead when we have the information in hand to tell us that it can be done on a sustainable basis. I think this is a remarkable achievement, and it's a model not only for fishery management councils everywhere, but also for the rest of the world.
Fish, of course, don't recognize international borders. How cooperative is the relationship with the U.S., between the U.S. and other Arctic nations when it comes to protecting fisheries?
The United States is involved in a number of regional fishery management agreements that entail negotiations among nations about fishery quotas, fishery management practices, etc. Our country is in a better position to be a good, strong negotiator when we have our own house in order, when we are managing our own fisheries well. Part of NOAA's responsibilities is to do both of those, to manage our fisheries well, but to also ensure that we have good representation that's based respectful of the science, based in the science, and is looking out for our interests in these international negotiations.
How do you see this changing, perhaps, as competition for Arctic resources heats up?
It's clear that there is keen and increasing interest in the Arctic. The melting of sea ice is a disaster for many of the species that are ice dependent. That melting is also creating new opportunities in the Arctic. As an Arctic nation, the United States has obligations to manage its activities and to engage in international dialogue with an eye toward the future, with an eye toward having healthy Arctic ecosystems, both for the peoples of the Arctic as well as the people of the world. This is a time of great change, and it's one that we have some real opportunities to be a leader in. I believe that the Ocean Policy Task Force's activities will help inform many of our policies having to do with the Arctic.
Fish farms are a big concern to commercial fishermen here in Alaska, but some consumers don't care where their fish in the supermarket comes from as long as it's cheap. Is there pressure to allow more offshore farming, and what do you think the future looks like for these operations?
I believe that aquaculture is a key part of our future food supply. That said, aquaculture needs to be done sustainably. What I believe the nation needs are good, clear policies about what does sustainable aquaculture look like. Who's responsible? Who's in charge? And that's true whether the aquaculture is happening in state waters or in federal waters. Aquaculture in federal waters is inevitably much more expensive than in state waters. We at NOAA are actively examining the question of what does sustainable aquaculture look like. And we'll be working with the administration and with Congress toward developing the appropriate types of national policies and practices to help ensure that.
There's been some horror stories about some of the practices of farming operations in other parts of the world. Do you think there is a way to do it safely and protect consumers and also protect oceans?
Aquaculture can be sustainable. Some types of aquaculture are easier to do sustainably than others. For example, it's much easier to have a sustainable oyster or clam or mussel aquaculture operation. The bar is a lot higher for finfish, especially finfish that are naturally carnivorous. As we look toward developing policies that regulate aquaculture, it's important that we consider the differences among different types of aquaculture and try to ensure that high standards are met, that the product is good and healthy, and that the environment is not degraded. And that's both the immediate environment as well as the wild-caught fisheries that interact with aquaculture operations.
The Arctic is a sink for toxins and pollutants that flow in from other countries. Many of the toxins found in the tissue samples of marine mammals reveal toxins that have been banned in the U.S. for decades. What is the U.S. doing to address this, and what is being done to encourage other nations to stop using these toxic compounds?
The toxins that have been identified in many Arctic species, including peoples, are of great concern. The international organizations that are part of the Arctic Council are a mechanism for working with other nations to have good information about where are those toxins, what are the sources, and what kind of international agreements should we be thinking of to reduce the risk from those toxins.
Dr. Jane Lubchenco is head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She spoke with Alaska Public Radio Network's Lori Townsend. Dr. Lubchenco was in Alaska for nearly a week recently to tour the state. She also held the first in a series of public meetings to help inform future federal policy on the nation's oceans. You've been listening to A Closer Look, a special KSKA program that takes an in-depth look at the people and issues that impact our community.